podcasting. This is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Lifetime documentary series Surviving R. Kelly details accusations that the musician sexually exploited minors and young women.
I felt like my silence allowed it to continue. I worked up the courage to come forward and tell my story. A part of me always felt like maybe I did something for him to treat me that way.
I want my story to be heard so people could take this situation seriously.
But when I found out it wasn't just me,
I just don't want it to get any worse.
While the allegations against R. Kelly are shocking, they are not isolated. The FBI says in Atlanta says it is one of the highest rates of child exploitation and trafficking in the country. Jennifer Frisco Bartle sees the lasting effects of these crimes every day. She's director of residential and clinical programs at Wellspring Living, which provides trauma-informed care and residential programs for female survivors of sexual abuse and exploitation. She's joining us in the studio. Jennifer, welcome.
Good morning.
So for people who have not seen the R. Kelly documentary, can you briefly tell us what kinds of allegations we're talking about?
Allegations of childhood sexual abuse, rape, statutory rape, sex with minors, and child pornography.
It's an unbelievably shocking story. And one of the allegations entails that he held women against their will, some of them teenagers, in houses in Chicago, in Atlanta. It's described as almost cult-like. Is that a technique that perpetrators use?
Absolutely. What it ends up looking like is Stockholm Syndrome. And what we call in our field is a trauma bond. So he has created relationships with people where he's used his position of power to make them feel as though they don't have a choice. I imagine the doors aren't locked. I imagine they can leave if they want to, which is why he's been able to skate by and avoid kidnapping charges. But he has brainwashed them to the point that they feel as though they have to stay.
And you heard one of those young women say, I figured it must have been me. So they think they belong there on some level?
Absolutely. They feel as though they have to stay. They owe him something, that they would be disappointing him if they left. He has really, in a sophisticated manner, removed any choice or any agency that they think they have.
Now, one of the places R. Kelly is accused of holding young women is in Metro Atlanta. What is it about this city that may have made that an option?
I think it could happen in any city. And I just imagine that he found a space here. There's a large music industry presence here, and he was doing work here, needed a home. I believe he had several homes. I think that trafficking happens in every city, in every state in the country. And unfortunately, regardless of what city you live in, if it's a large metropolitan city like Atlanta or a more rural city, for many different reasons, we don't see it when it's happening right in front of us, and it then becomes kind of easy to look away or imagine that it's not happening.
But do these issues show up in Georgia in ways that they may not in other places?
Definitely. This is a large metropolitan city, Atlanta. We have the busiest airport. We have sports teams, convention center. So there are lots of reasons for people to come through Atlanta, and it's ripe for people to want to participate in what we call sex tourism.
That's often the way that we think of it, right? That we think of sexual exploitation and trafficking of minors, maybe putting sex workers on the street. But there's a lot more going on. So what are some of the other forms that it does take?
It actually doesn't happen much on the street anymore. Most of it happens online, and it's prearranged. So when people come here for sexual tourism, they've arranged what they're looking for in a sexual experience with the traffickers before they get here.
I think a lot of people who watch that documentary and hearing stories like this could be asking, you know, how could this happen? And can you help flesh that out? What are some of the ways that perpetrators lure young women into these kind of situations?
It's often a person of power. So in R. Kelly's instance, I mean, these girls thought he was a god. They thought that he was doing them a favor by allowing them to even be in his presence. But it doesn't have to be that sophisticated, and you don't have to be a celebrity. You just have to be somebody that knows how to take advantage of somebody's vulnerabilities.
How about witnesses, though? Family and friends?
I think that we don't want to believe that this happens. We can't imagine that somebody would take advantage of someone, a child or an adult, in that way. And it's a little bit nuanced. So when it looks as though they have a choice to leave, we can be judgmental. We often, just as humans, tend to blame the victim. If your purse snatched, we don't say, "I'm sorry that that happened to you." We say, "Why did you have your purse in your buggy? You should have been paying better attention."
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also the well-worn image of who is being exploited. And one juror who was quoted in the Lifetime series argued he didn't consider young Black women to be victims because of the way they, quote, dressed and acted. Now, Georgia Cares, that's the state coordinating agency supporting child survivors of sex trafficking and exploitation, they found that over half of the survivors they worked with over just the last year were young women or young girls of color. How do these perceptions of race play into that victim blaming?
I think that that is an excellent point. It's easier for us to turn a blind eye to groups that we feel are marginalized, that don't look like us, that don't represent us. And so if you can put somebody into a category of other, it makes it easier for you to think, well, that can't happen to me, can't happen to my kids. And maybe because we have this construct of what a young Black woman should look like or should act like or is for sexually, then what things happen to her are probably her fault.
So, but I think there's often the other case is made that so many young women are sexualized in our culture. So it's not just young women of color, but you said if they don't look or act like us. So we're looking again at the predominating culture looking at the other.
It's absolutely the other. Yep.
Class dynamics are also involved in situations like this. So how does that, the socioeconomic or the poverty play into that?
Well, all of those things play into it. It really is a social justice issue. So you have the other of being female. So you've got gender. You have the other of being raised in poverty or having to go without. Oftentimes, kids that we work with say the way that they were recruited or introduced was somebody bought them a meal. So if your needs aren't being met, it's easy then for somebody to come in and offer you what they think you need. Then you feel like you owe them, and then they get you to do something that you might not want to do. So you put race and gender and class, and then you add in sometimes LGBTQ status. You have a group of people that we can just put in this other category that we don't have to pay attention to.
Is there a particular risk for LGBTQ youth?
Youth who are LGBTQ identified, and particularly transgendered youth, are at an increased risk for being trafficked. Transgender youth in Atlanta, looking for jobs, looking for places to work, and if they are in the process of transitioning, oftentimes it's difficult for them to find jobs, and they begin to feel that the only work for them is sex work.
Well, the Fulton County District Attorney's Office is investigating a Metro Atlanta case related to R. Kelly. Mother and father say that their daughters got caught up with R. Kelly and that they haven't heard from the young women in years. How do perpetrators isolate their victims in this way? As you say, you know, even when the door may not be locked.
Isolation is key. If the perpetrator can remove you from any other perspectives other than the one that he or she wants you to have, you begin to think that they're the only voice of reason. Also, there's a lot of shame and stigma associated with the things that go on in human trafficking and sex work and transactional sex relationships. So young people begin to feel further and further removed from their family the more they're in it and the more that they are isolated from those other perspectives. So they begin to believe if their perpetrator tells them, your family won't take you back. You can't go back to a regular high school and go to prom and be a regular kid because you're forever different now.
Who was protecting him?
All of the adults around him. I also would believe and suggest that the people that continue to buy his music, the people that continue to support him, the people that continue to say, to separate who he is as an artist from what he does as a human. So in the documentary, they talked about R. Kelly versus Robert Kelly being two different people, same people, and the music bears that out.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Frisco Bartle. She's director of residential and clinical programs at Wellspring Living. Well, let's get into that a little bit, because there's this movement, Mute R. Kelly, created by black women, popularized by a Twitter hashtag. They argue that for a full boycott of the artist and his music. We know that Lady Gaga pulled her collaborations with him from streaming platforms, so did Chance the Rapper. Bethany Walker Branch and Kurt Reynolds, they had a conversation about this for Atlanta's Next Gen Radio.
I was an R. Kelly fan coming up. Wholeheartedly, I mean, to be honest with you, it probably wasn't until I actually did a very, very minor amount of research into the allegations against him that I realized, this guy's a sicko.
Right.
And I never really knew that. So I feel, you know, if you do separate the artist from the art, you're essentially allowing someone to, you know, operate without any consequences.
So there's the hate the sin, love the sinner kind of idea in that support. Is listening to R. Kelly's music supporting him?
Absolutely. Absolutely. He is able to get away with what he does because he hasn't felt any pain. He hasn't lost anything. He's had no consequences personally or professionally or legally.
So this week, R. Kelly's Essential Hits album landed on the Billboard 200 charts. Doing well, seemingly in response to the documentary. Is there a backlash then to the backlash?
That's frightening for me. There's no denying that he is a talented artist, whether you like his music or not. However, I don't think you can separate the two. And we vote with what we spend our money on. So if we are saying, you know, I can listen to this music and he's benefiting from that, then he doesn't feel any loss. And so for people, you asked me earlier, you know, who's helping him? The adults that are around him, but it's the people that's buying his music. It's the people that continue to attend the concerts that are essentially saying without saying, whatever else you're doing off stage, it's either okay with me or I don't care.
Let's talk about the survivors here. You've spent more than 20 years working with women and children, now interact with survivors at Wellspring Living. How do they eventually get out of these abusive, traumatic environments?
Oftentimes the kids and the women that we work with, they don't recognize themselves as survivors or victims of human trafficking. That's a pretty big definition that we use to raise awareness of the issues. They think I was in a relationship with somebody who really cared about me. He took great care of me. All traffickers aren't men also. So she fed me. She provided me a place to stay. She was kinder to me than my own parents. So often those relationships that end up being really abusive and really manipulative, they don't recognize it as such until they've been removed from it. So they were isolated. In some ways, we need to isolate them from those manipulative relationships to get them to see, you know, maybe there is another way. Maybe that relationship that I thought was so helpful to me was actually really hurtful.
But once they get out of that psychological hold, I imagine there's a lot of work to do, you know, physically, emotionally, to heal. And with all of that shame, how do you at Wellspring and other organizations, for that matter, help them heal?
It starts with some psychoeducation about what trafficking is. So that's, again, a big word, but break it down to the smaller pieces so they recognize that that is, in fact, what happened to them. And then it starts with building them back up as a whole human with the things that they're interested in. So for kids, that's what are you interested in school? We have kids who come to our school on campus in our program and they say, I want to learn more. Can we have a language class? I want to be doing all these things that I missed out on when I wasn't in school. So these aren't kids to be thrown away. These are kids who want to thrive. In our women's program, we have women who say, I want a job. I want to work in an office. I want to work at Delta. I have other skills to offer besides my body. And I would like to make a living wage doing something meaningful.
So did the documentary open the door, do you think, for other victims to tell their stories? I mean, when it was released, several made memes and even jokes on social media online. Has this uncovered traumatic memories for other victims?
It's definitely, I think, been triggering for people to see what happened to them. Again, the shame and stigma serves to protect the perpetrator because we just don't talk about what happened to us. And now people are seeing, well, maybe if she can tell her story and she can go on TV and cry and talk about the really horrific things that happen, then maybe I could do the same thing.
Well, as you mentioned, you know, it's hard to wrap your head around the fact that his sales are booming. And but there have been arguments that I've seen bubbling up that white perpetrators of crimes like this are not chased down in the same way as high-profile black men like R. Kelly or like a Bill Cosby, for example, that just comes to mind. How do we navigate these conversations when there is also real harm to real people?
Right. So it's dangerous to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. So to say, because men of color tend to be perpetrated, tend to be prosecuted, tend to be incarcerated at much higher rates, that if somebody is doing something wrong, like Bill Cosby, like OJ, like R. Kelly, that we would turn the other way. So we can't have it both ways. So yes, we should be addressing the higher rates of incarceration and prosecution of people of color, particularly men of color. And there are men of color who are committing real crimes that need to be held accountable.
How about the perception? I mean, right now we're talking about saving victims. 20 years ago, prosecutors were still focused on throwing, you know, so-called prostitutes into prison. How has that changed?
We don't use that word anymore. If you can't consent for sex, you can't be a child prostitute. So we call that a victim of human trafficking, of sexual exploitation of children. So the laws are different now. Instead, if you are recovered with a buyer or with a trafficker, you get services, you get help instead of being blamed.
Jennifer Frisco Bartle, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
She's Director of Residential and Clinical Programs at Wellspring Living, helps provide trauma-informed care for female survivors of sexual abuse and exploitation. Coming up to the break, back with more on Second Thought.